For the week of October 13th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 209, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the planet Tatooine, I'm Michael Gill.
Why are you on Tatooine? Tatooine, of course, being the planet from Star Wars.
Where Luke Skywalker grew up. Yes, because I'm a fool. That's why I'm there. I've been exiled to Tatooine because 2 weeks ago, we talked about this video slash open letter, a fan letter about Star Wars, where they were telling J.J. Abrams, hey, this is what you got to do to make Star Wars great again. And we mentioned casually the cute score that the video included, which is basically a cappella voices humming the theme from Star Wars, to which I then went,
That's Indiana Jones.
Exactly. But you didn't catch it. I didn't catch it. But my friends caught it and they mocked me and said, you idiot, you fool. That is John Williams, but it's not Star Wars. And they all said, well, how many emails did you get? How many letters? I said, oh, I don't know. Sperling will probably, you know, tear me up next week when we get all the letters and make fun of me. But apparently everybody thought it was such a stupid mistake. They didn't bother to respond. They figured someone else would do it. So now here I am stuck on tattooing, paying my penalty for not humming ba 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 or something else from Star Wars. So I apologize, but all credit to John Williams because he is a master of the catchy theme song.
Well, you know why I didn't catch it, Michael, was because I was too busy nominating our show, and unfortunately I can only do it once, for the 2013 Podcast Awards. They're being held, I guess, in January of next year at the Consumer Electronics Show. And every year I miss the deadline. But this year, not only am I not missing the deadline, I'm actually remembering to mention it during one of our episodes. And frankly, Grant, you know, I will take the heat on the fact that you only have one day to nominate us if you download this podcast on Monday the 14th.
You mean, it comes out, the deadline is tomorrow?
Yes.
Oh, well, then we're really screwed.
Yes. Well, but if you listen to us, please go to podcastawards.com and please nominate us both. I guess it's in a best of show. I don't know what it is. It's like a best produced. I can't remember. I guess
People's Choice.
People's Choice. Thank you. It's one of those, like, you know, all encompassing ones, as well as the entertainment section. I know I've nominated us. Have you?
I'm doing it right now.
Yeah, that's what they all say.
I am. And remember, it is like voting. It's like voting in a presidential election. If you actually vote, you can really change the outcome because most people don't vote. If everyone who listened to our show actually voted for us, we'd probably win.
That's actually true. To be honest, that's very, very true.
Yeah. I mean, you could make it happen. But, you know, you're cool enough to listen to the show. Make yourself even cooler by making us an award winner.
Yes. And of course, you would have known this if you had listened to last week's show, because I did mention it on last week's show.
Well, I just record the show. I don't actually listen to it. And apparently you added that in afterwards. So yes. I don't think I'm to blame.
Okay. Well, on today's show, we should probably talk about today's show since.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, we're going to be joined by our former co-host, Karen Woodward.
Yay!
She's, of course, now a social media consultant for all these big entertainment industry companies. She's going to stop by and help us explain all this news about how Twitter and Facebook are fighting over television domination. And by help us explain, what I really mean is I hope she can tell us what the heck is going on here. It's the end of the year, which means everybody is talking about awards, and we don't want to be considered different or special by not mentioning them. So we'll tell you how a record 76 countries have submitted films for Best Foreign Language Oscar consideration. Too bad only 5 can be nominated. Thankfully, though, Spotify has more than 76 songs. They have about, what, 20 million tracks?
That's right.
Unfortunately, 4 million of them have never been streamed a single time. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gils to fill us in on the worldwide box office over the weekend.
That's right. And some things are defying gravity by getting bigger and bigger every week. That's, of course, Gravity, the blockbuster film starring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. And it's the number one movie around the world. It grossed $72 million. Even China is opening its arms up to Gravity because they just approved it for release in that country. It's always a mystery whether you'll actually get to show your movie in China. They were running out of slots this year. They also have a big space program and don't like to glorify the achievements of the West in space. They want to talk about their own achievements. But Gravity apparently has a few little references to China in the movie. A Chinese spaceship plays a role at one point in the film. It's sort of a port in a storm. And there are little references to Chinese presence technologically in space. just as there are references to Russia, that may be just a coincidence, because, of course, they have a big and growing presence in space. Or Alfonso Cuarón and his brother, or the studio said, hey, make sure you say nice things about China, and maybe we'll actually get our movie released there. Whatever the reason, it's coming to China, and that will only add to its box office. Right now, this weekend, it grossed $72 million worldwide, and its total is $191 million, with a lot more to come.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing. 2 weeks, $191 million for a 90-minute, basically, two people are in this movie.
That's right.
That's absolutely, I actually heard somebody say, and the kid was like, I don't know, 10 years old, and he said, oh, actually, Gravity's a really good movie, even though it's not only 90 minutes.
It's a phenomenon. I don't want to oversell it, but I don't know why people all of a sudden just said, oh my God, I have to see this movie. But everybody did. It helped that it had the film festival stamp of approval that gave it that cachet of being critically acclaimed. It has big stars, of course. It has some technological pushing of the boundaries. But basically, everyone just said, two people alone in space, trapped, in danger, gotta see it. My mother wants to see it. My nephews want to see it. Everybody wants to see it.
Well, you know, maybe when China can send their own movie stars into space to film a movie, they can show a movie like, you know, a homegrown movie like Gravity.
That's right. Well, let's get to Captain Phillips, the number one two movie around the world and the number two movie in North America, which is basically the only place it opened. It grossed $26 million. That's where it's at right now. It stars Tom Hanks, based on a true story. As with all true stories, people are now saying, well, all the facts aren't exactly lined up.
Well, Captain Phillips wasn't such a nice guy. He was actually kind of mean, and he put himself in that position.
Right. So this movie cost $55 million to make. It also had the film festival stamp of approval. It opened up at the New York Film Festival and got very good reviews. Opened wide. Tom Hanks is a big star. This is a big trend for Hollywood. We'll see it a little bit later with Prisoners, the Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman film. And there's Rush, which hasn't done great, but is the same idea. Hollywood is having success with mid-level movies geared towards adults. Captain Phillips is made for adults. Gravity, you can take kids to it, but it's really a film for adults. You know what I mean? And that's a $100 million movie because it was so technologically challenging. But Prisoners, also a mid-level movie as far as budget is concerned, made for adults. Rush isn't working in North America, but it's doing a little better overseas. But again, a movie made for adults. Hollywood has to have a mix of big blockbusters like The Hobbit and the new reboot of Jack Ryan and, you know, Marvel's The Avengers. And it needs low-budget movies and animated films, and it needs movies like these. It's 2 weeks in a row now. You've had a movie come out that's well-reviewed, starring big stars, and making a lot of money. And they're made for adults. Gravity's not geared towards kiddies. Captain Phillips is clearly for adults. You can take teenagers to it. It's not a violent film as such or an envelope-pushing film. But it's clearly not one geared towards 12-year-old boys. And that's a great sign for Hollywood. And hopefully they'll learn the lesson. You got to have a mix. You got to have mid-level movies. You can't just make $200 million films and $1 million pickups.
What you're saying is product diversity is a good thing.
That's right. And, you know, why drop the ball on something like adults? Because they go to lots of movies. And now at number three is a movie not strictly for adults. It's really for kids. It's called Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. It grossed $23 million worldwide. It's at $99 million, so it's just about to pass $100 million. In North America, it has the field wide open for family films for another few weeks, so this is going to have good legs and do quite well for the studio. It's a sequel that costs less than the original. It's geared towards kids, but it has enough smarts adults can enjoy it. It doesn't seem to be quite as good as the first one, but it's good enough, and so they're going to have a success with it.
How could you say no to any movie that has a Takasaurus in it? Or a chimpanzee, for that matter.
I couldn't. At number four is Stalingrad. It grossed $15 million worldwide. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume this is a Russian film.
Possibly.
I doubt the Germans want to make a film about Stalingrad, which is basically the Russian Alamo is the only way to think about it. And in fact, we looked it up. It is a Russian film. It's directed by Fedor Bondarchuk, who is the son of Sergei Bondarchuk, the famed Russian director who starred and directed War and Peace, and it won an Oscar. So, you know, he's a big figure in Russian cinema, though not a wildly talented one. But his son Fedor has a small role and directed Stalingrad. It's a $30 million film. It's the first Russian film shot entirely in 3D.
Wow.
It's also the first non-American film shot entirely in IMAX. It's in 3D and it's in IMAX. It's my worst nightmare.
So wait a second. Let me get this straight. They shot IMAX film, 35 millimeter, or in this case, 65 millimeter film, and they shot it in 3D. They didn't go back and post-process.
I don't know how that's what it says on Wikipedia.
Wow.
So because, you would know about the technical challenges more than me, but that's what it says.
So they basically spent all of the money in Russia to make this movie.
They said it cost $30 million. So that doesn't sound like a ton. And it is an epic period piece. They spent about 10 days filming the big battle scenes. And the rest of it is like a romantic triangle set at this one big estate in the middle of Stalingrad. They managed to turn a horrific tale of war and violence and starvation into a love story.
Yeah, well,
sounds like they're learning the lessons of Hollywood.
Yeah, and that's what you really want IMAX for, those wonderful love stories.
Yeah, 3D IMAX, go see it. Number five, Around the World, Prisoners, that film we referenced before, another $11 million. It's at $76 million and counting. And number six, another animated film, Despicable Me 2, another $10 million. It's at $885 million. It will, of course, pass the $900 million mark. I don't think it'll hit $1 billion, but oh my gosh, that puts it into the top 30 of all-time movies.
Wow.
$900 million, a lot of money for Despicable Me 2. At number seven, Insidious Chapter 2. That made $9 million, as did Runner Runner, the Justin Timberlake, Ben Affleck movie. Those both made around $9 million. Insidious Chapter 2, a low-budget horror film, that's made $114 million worldwide. Runner Runner, a low-budget nothing movie, it's made $45 million worldwide.
It just goes to show you why, when you go to Cannes and the American film market and all of these film markets, people are always saying, well, what A-list star do you have in your horrible, schlocky movie? Because even horrible, schlocky movies can still make money if done for a price. And $45 million worldwide, why? Ben Affleck and Justin Timberlake, that's why.
Yeah, and it costs $30 million to make. So, you know, they're on their way to profitability.
Right.
And, of course, they probably sold it off market by market. They may have already made their money back.
That's true.
At number nine around the world is Ron Howard's Rush, the racing movie about Formula One. Another $8 million. That's at $62 million and counting. All right, it's not going to probably be a success story. It may edge into profitability, but it's not going to make a lot of money, obviously. It's probably not an Oscar hopeful, even though some people like to pretend it still is. Maybe Daniel Brühl will get a supporting actor nod, though best supporting actor is always a tough, tough competition slot. Nonetheless, they only made it for about $40 million. You roll the dice. Not every movie's going to work. It doesn't mean you say, oh, we can't make movies about adults anymore. It's like, you know, it was a reasonable film to make, and they're not going to lose much money because they made it for the right price.
Now, and I would agree with you. Okay, G4 Television. Okay, now you're going to think, why is he mentioning television in the midst of box office? G4 Television was all about tech and video games. They decided.
Oh, right.
Comcast decided, hey, you know what? We're gonna change that into the Esquire network, and it'll be like fashion and style. They fired everybody from G4, and then they decided, nah, maybe we won't do that. But maybe we'll, we don't know what we're going to do with it, but we need programming for that network. So they're putting on all of these old movies, all of these old television shows. And so you always need new content for, not for hopefully networks that are basically lying dormant.
That sounds more like a bad idea of how to run a network than a good idea for programming.
Right, but for networks that you actually care about, you need new programming. Guess what? This will actually maybe even break even theatrically. Then you've got Blu-ray and DVD and premium cable and VOD and streaming.
Has it been sold to G4?
No, but it's a Universal film.
Okay, I see. So it might will be shown up on that channel at some point.
Yes.
Certainly the major networks aren't going to be competing to broadcast it.
No.
They will, however, be competing to broadcast Now You See Me, the film about illusionists who pull off a heist to give money to the poor. God bless them. I wish they'd give some to me. It grossed $8 million. It's at $333 million worldwide with a nice round number, but it's not done yet. Planes, that's at $190 million worldwide, and that made about $6 million, as did Young Detective D, which we've talked about quite a bit. Turbo, which is just under $6 million. That passed the $200 million mark. And again, it is, maybe it's a snail. Maybe it will slowly but surely get to the finish line of $300 million worldwide, but I doubt it. And then up above there at $6 million also is Hawaii. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that correctly because it's not supposed to sound like Hawaii, the island. It's Hawaii, or I'm not sure. It's called H-W-A-Y-I, A Monster Boy. It is, of course, a South Korean film because they make every movie around the world, it seems like. It opened to $6 million. It's sort of a male spin on Hannah, that movie about a little girl raised to be an assassin. Ooh. This is about a little boy who was kidnapped, and then the kidnappers were stuck with him, and so they raised him in the wilderness all alone and trained him to be the perfect assassin. And then all hell breaks loose.
You know, whenever I kidnap a small child, I always turn them into an assassin.
Absolutely. There's no other way to go. So that's the box office around the world. Gravity is the big story. It's really tearing it up. on weekdays, it was grossing $6 million, $7 million, $5 million. Those are numbers you see at the height of summer or the holiday movie-going season between Christmas and New Year. It's really playing like just an out-of-the-box, massive word-of-mouth, big, big hit.
You know what,
and anybody who says movie stars don't matter is out of their mind. You could have worked with nobodies, but I'm telling you, it certainly helped to have George Clooney and Sandra Bullock stranded in space.
Yeah, and it's, you know, great that Alfonso Cuarón could figure out a way to actually get them into space to shoot this movie.
Absolutely. That's just one of the many things that Hollywood can accomplish.
That's right.
And of course, another thing Hollywood can accomplish is bringing attention to movies from around the world. How do they do that?
Oh, I wonder if you're talking about, say, all of these awards that we give out at the end of the year. We give out one or two or 300, right?
Right. But the important one is the Academy Awards.
Yes. The big kahuna, the big whale, if you will, is the Academy Awards. And this year, there are 76 foreign language Oscar submissions. It's a record.
Never been as because there are more countries.
I think that the UN is creating countries just to make this particular category in the Oscar race a little bit more challenging.
Well, you know, maps always change. Countries are always being formed and broken apart. But it's a record because, of course, it's cheaper and easier to make movies than ever.
That
helps a lot. You don't need the infrastructure as much as you did in the past.
True.
That's got to be a big help, right?
Yeah, but, you know, this year, what the big news, of course, besides the 76 movies, is that there's no huge frontrunner. There's no kind of Amour, like Michael Haneke's Amour last year. Everybody thought, well, it's going to be nominated for Best Picture, but let's face it, it will win Best Foreign Language Feature, and sure enough, it did.
And that some of the movies that you might have looked for, like Japan's Like Father, Like Son, weren't even chosen by their own country.
Right. Now, that's a big controversy of how countries...
It always happens.
Every year you hear this. But basically, every country has a little group inside the country, a little commission that's set up that can nominate and select from that country's movies a film made by its filmmakers that can then be sent for submission to the Academy for consideration in that category, Best Foreign Language Feature. So,
Blah, blah, blah. Countries choose each country chooses their one film to submit. We know that. And also we know that this year it changes that everybody's going to get DVDs of the movies that are on the short list or the mid list before they make their final choice. So everyone will have a chance to watch all the foreign films and vote on them rather than having to go to a certain place and time and see the movies and check a box and swear you saw them and draw blood. You know, it'll be a lot easier, just like with animated films, for everybody at the Academy to vote for their best foreign language film.
Do you think that will have any effect on who wins this award this year?
Sure. I mean, not in the sense that movie A will beat movie B. It's more that it will affect, that it reflects the voting Academy rather than a quirky group of elderly members who have the time to go see these movies. You know, the broader the basis of people voting, the more reflective it'll be of the actual Academy. You won't have perhaps the bizarro quirkiness that has plagued the best foreign language film in years past. They would have five movies. Two of them would be incredibly well-known popular movies that people loved and thought were great, and they choose some obscure film that never made any waves and wasn't even really well thought of because it appealed to the people who happened to go see the five films. Now, with everybody having a chance to vote, weigh in at the finale, more likely that the best film, or the film certainly that the Academy thinks is best, will actually win.
And I agree with Mark Johnson. He's the head of the Academy's Foreign Language Committee, and I think also, if I'm not mistaken, a producer. I believe it's the same Mark Johnson. That committee has about 300 members. And he said, look, you know, we really, I guess, do have to think about whether we consider...
He may change the rules and come up with some new way of doing it. I'll tell you what, here's what you do. Stick with the way you have it doing it now. Every country gets to submit a film, and any film that opens commercially in North America during the calendar year, commercial one-week run, just like for the Academy consideration, any film from any country in the world that opens in America is eligible to be nominated for Best Foreign Language Film.
You know what? I really like that idea, and here's why. Not only is it very clear-cut as to what the rule is, but it also helps foreign language features get shown in the United States. It would actually help broaden the market because there would be distributors that really push some of these films.
There would be qualifying runs, of course. But right now, a lot of times, they wait and hope and say, okay, we've got a great film. We think it's going to get a nomination. And they hold off and release it in March, pegged to around the Academy Award nominations and awards. And so you've got this flurry of foreign language films in March, which is unreasonable. This would spread it out. Any movie that gets released any time during the year, you're eligible. And then you've got big successful foreign language films that come to America and are seen and people are actually talking about, they have a chance to be nominated.
Yeah, whereas sometimes I find that the films have already been released, like The White Ribbon had been, I don't know whether it had been released pre or post Oscars, but so maybe that's a bad example. But a lot of times the films don't even get released until after they've
right, because they use the Oscars as a promotional tool, which is understandable. People don't flock to a lot of foreign language films. But again, it creates this unnatural thing where the movies that are actually being nominated aren't getting shown until after the Oscars. So it's just a bad system. I think that simple rule, if it's shown in America, it's eligible, would open up the process, allow popular films like Father, Like Son to be nominated, assuming it opens here. And it would just be a way to broaden it in a very simple, direct way.
Now, I know Scott Feinberg over at The Hollywood Reporter is continuously every week, it seems. In fact, I believe it is every week. He's saying, well, here's the latest, you know, in the Oscar race. I'm thinking, did this race start yet? But I guess it did.
It's almost over.
Exactly.
It's almost over because, as he points out, virtually all the Oscar hopefuls have already been seen by the industry.
And usually there's one holdout that's like December 25th, we'll open some big movie that winds up being, you know, like a Zero Dark 30. And it's kind of a dark horse. You don't know whether it's going to be good or bad or whether it will play into the Oscars or not. This year, they've all been played.
Right. Well, there are six films left that are wild cards that could play into the race that haven't been seen yet. But it is October. I mean, we've got, you know, almost... we've got 2.5 months before the end of the year. So it is kind of a surprise when the fall is known for big Oscar movies. They're all being seen at film festivals. They're all being seen at industry screenings. So 12 Years a Slave, Inside Llewellyn Davis, Gravity, Blue Jasmine, Captain Phillips, The Butler, all those movies I've seen. There are about six left that will probably have the potential to be spoilers, basically based on the pedigree of the people involved. That's American Hustle, directed by David O. Russell and starring Christian Bale. Lone Survivor, a Peter Berg film about Navy SEALs starring Mark Wahlberg. The Monuments Men, directed and starring George Clooney, about a team rescuing art during World War II. Out of the Furnace, which is very unlikely. I don't know why he mentioned it. A Scott Cooper film starring Christian Bale and Casey Affleck. Saving Mr. Banks, starring Tom Hanks again and Emma Thompson, about the making of Mary Poppins.
I've seen extended clips of that. It looks very, very interesting.
Interesting as in... charming and delightful, or oh my god, what a great film.
Somewhere in between.
All right, and finally, The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese directing Leonardo DiCaprio. And to prove,
but wait a second, I thought The Wolf of Wall Street was being pushed. Is that, am I wrong about that?
Well, David Feinberg says no, he believes it will be shown and screened and released before the end of the year.
Okay,
but we don't know, we're waiting to hear about that. So, six movies, and of course, he has a list of all the Oscar hopefuls. He lists like 30 movies, 40 movies. My god, he lists every movie made all year long, but he has like 10 or 12 that are listed as front runners for best picture to prove that the movies we love best are the movies we haven't seen. As in, I'm so excited to see that movie. Four of these six movies are front runners for the best picture nomination.
Oh, wow.
We haven't seen them, but they're somehow front runners.
Okay, well, yeah.
It seems silly to me. It's like, why talk about movies when you haven't seen them yet? You know, oh my god, I can't. American Hustle, The Monuments Men, Saving Mr. Banks, The Wolf of Wall Street, all front runners for Best Picture, even though, as he says, no one has seen them.
Well, you know, it's like USC always being ranked number one.
On paper.
Yeah, in the American college football poll, and then they start the season,
and
they lose their
play.
First two games, and they're like, not even ranked anymore.
Yeah, so that's the Oscar race. It's actually a much farther along than you would think. I think we've got a good idea of what certainly five of the films are going to be, and we'll have to see how it all plays out.
Well, speaking of playing out, I know that for me, these days, most of the time, most often, I'm actually playing my music, not from CDs and not even from MP3s, but through Spotify. I don't play Pandora so much anymore, but Songza is a service I use. But Spotify is kind of my go-to for the most part.
Maybe because they have 20 million tracks.
That's true. And I'm going to make it my mission in life to play all of the 4 million tracks that have never been streamed, not even once.
Come again?
Yes. Well, Spotify turned 5 this week. And to celebrate, they decided to release an infographic. That's like the new trend these days. Hey, you want some information? Here are some pictures that kind of tell the story of the information.
I don't think that's a trend so much as something that's been done throughout history.
Well, fine. Take okay. Away my trend.
Trend. A graph.
Yeah.
they've decided to use math, strangely enough. Okay, go.
Infographics are the new black.
Yeah.
In any case,
what did this, as you call it, chart reveal?
Well, it revealed that there are a billion playlists on Spotify, and that of the 20
billion,
a billion.
Have you created one?
I've created a few, yes.
Okay.
One or two or 10, yes. But I don't think they expected people to do the very thing you're mentioning, Michael, math, because they said, we have 20 million tracks available, and 80% of them have been played, which means 20% of them have not been played, not even once.
Not even once. Not even by the artist who posted them.
That's true.
Well, I mean, our podcast gets at least 2 plays every week, right? By God, we're going to listen to it and love it.
That's true. And we might be the only ones. We're going to write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com and complain about us.
Michael's a jerk.
Wait a
second. By the way, I've already voted for us on podcastawards.com. It's that easy. And there are like 5 categories we're eligible. There's movies, there's entertainment, there's cultural, there's best audience award. So, you know, vote away. It's very easy. All you need is a name and an email address. And you just type in our name and our URL, you know, showbizsandbox.com. That's it. You don't have to do anything. It's not complicated. It's not simple. Go do it.
You mean it is simple?
It's not hard.
It's not
That's
hard.
That's what I meant to say.
Okay. I would actually point out that you just gave a mid-story plug to podcastawards.com, but you did that in the middle of the show?
Sure, why not? Some people jump right to the middle because it's their favorite part. Now, I love an idea
You were able to nominate us while recording the show. That's how easy it is.
Oh, yes, exactly. So now Brad Hill has a great idea what to do about this, doesn't he?
Yes. Now, I don't know what Rain is, to be honest. I guess I should have gone there. I think it's an online industry trade about streaming music. I don't know. I'm going to go find out. But Brad Hill wrote, create a quote-unquote untouched tracks playlist, which auto-updates with each new edition and removes tracks the moment they are first streamed from the playlist. Award honor points to users who get first streamer bragging rights, and an adventurous listener award every month to the user who has first listened to the most music. Promoted adequately, and that 20% of unstreamed statistic will shrink in no time. I agree. I think it's a great idea. I am sure some of this music is unlistenable.
Rain, by the way, is the radio and internet newsletter.
And that there is why I've never heard of it.
Because you don't care about the radio or the internet?
No, I don't subscribe to that newsletter.
There you go. Maybe you will. I bet you subscribe. Well, you don't subscribe to The Guardian, but that's a UK newspaper that has been actively and aggressively turning itself into a brand worldwide. They've really done a big job of investing in their digital platform, and reaching out around the world. It's a nonprofit newspaper backed by a foundation, and their goal is to be a moderate liberal voice in the UK. And so they've done a really good job of spreading their stories around the world. And one of the benefits of that is they get some big names to write articles for them and opinion pieces and stuff like that who may not necessarily, you know, have a presence in the UK as such. I mean, David Byrne of Talking Heads, you know, you don't think of him as London or the UK, but they got him to write an article about music and Spotify and all these streaming services.
Yeah, I mean, I would say David Byrne is
grounded
he's known
all over the world.
Yeah, but he's grounded in New York. I mean, everybody knows
him. Oh, yeah. He rides his bike.
Yes, exactly. Right next to Leonardo DiCaprio.
I almost ran over Elvis Costello.
Are you serious? Well,
didn't really,
I love
but
Elvis
we were in
Costello.
A lane, the light turned green, we're about to go, and there's Elvis Costello shambling along like an absent-minded professor, and I'm like, whoa, we can't run over Elvis Costello, let him go by. So he glances at our big car, glances at the light, realizes, of course they're waiting, I'm Elvis Costello, and he walked across anyway. So we let him pass and did not cause music nightmares for the people of the world. We did not run over Elvis Costello.
Well, I'm very glad because I'm a huge fan of Elvis Costello, and I'm becoming a huge fan of The Guardian. I agree with you, Michael. They are doing, this newspaper is doing a stellar job of branding themselves, not only in the UK, but because I've always known that they were there. Anybody who is media savvy, I suppose, knows about The Guardian and The Telegraph in the UK, but they are more and more appearing as sources in other media outlets' stories.
Well, they've invested in investigative reporting, just like Huffington Post has invested and other outlets. That's where you can make your mark worldwide. Break news that nobody else has, and everybody will come to your door. They're doing a great job. They're nonprofit, and they're only losing about £50 million a year.
How much?
They're losing tens of millions of dollars, if not, you know, they're losing money left hand over fist.
Oh, I thought you were saying that they figured out the best diet in the world. Okay.
Oh, no. So David Byrne wrote an article for them about Spotify. What does it say?
It says Spotify bad. Very, very bad. Actually, he says the internet will suck all creative content out of the world. And that very last bit of content will sound like...
But isn't the internet making content available to everyone in the world more easily and more inexpensively than ever before?
That's true, but I'm shocked.
Oh, that's true. But anyway, moving on.
Well, I'm just shocked you didn't make mention of the fact that I made that slurping sound.
That was perfectly fine.
Oh, okay.
So he makes a couple good points, of course. He says, why are we giving so much money to these people? Why do the artists get the least amount of money? Why do record labels and Spotify get most of it, and the artists who actually create it get very little? But of course, you're between a rock and a hard place. You need a label to get to the world in most cases, or you need Spotify to launch your unnamed act. So if you need visibility and you're a small act, you go to them. If you're a really big act, you can actually make some money and you'll go to them. But the 95% of people in the middle, the people who have recording careers, but will make very modest amounts from Spotify, like, I don't know, Richard Thompson and, you know, a million other mid-level acts, they're going to make pennies on the dollar and get nothing from it. And yet that's how you create 20 million tracks.
Yes. And he's also asking, you know, this is a question that I would ask our audience. Why would you ever buy a CD or pay for a download when you can stream your favorite albums and artists either for free or for a nominal monthly charge?
Because CDs sound a lot better than compressed MP3 when I'm sitting at home.
See, I would agree with you on that. However, how many of us have ripped the CD that we purchase? I do this. And then put it into iTunes, because that's how we play the music back, and then kind of store the CD away somewhere. I know I do that all the time, because, you know, having CDs lying around, I have thousands of CDs, trying to go through them to find what it is I want, as opposed to just typing a few letters and going, oh, yes, Elvis Costello, that guy that Michael Giltz almost ran over. Yes, I'll play his music.
Have you tried alphabetizing?
Yeah, yes, but then, you know, after a while, you run out of shelf space, and then you have to, like, re-alphabetize everything and shift all the CDs. I mean, this is a first-world problem if I've ever heard one.
Hey, exactly. Well, no, it's true. It's a lot easier to access your music digitally. Hopefully, Neil Young will come through with a good, you know, digital music format that people can embrace and isn't so huge of a file that it's actually portable and can be used, and we can hear great-sounding music again. Unfortunately, we're doing it through our laptop computer speakers, right?
Well, no, I have it set up through regular stereo speakers.
Oh, very, very good. Very good. So David Byrne weighed in. He didn't say anything new, but what grabbed this about you? What about it made you say, I want to share this story?
Well, because of that question, why buy a CD when you could stream for little to no money? Because I found myself walking out of Amoeba, as I mentioned in a previous episode, walking out of Amoeba Record Store recently, probably one of the best record stores presently around today in the world, not just the United States. It has millions of albums, millions of CDs, used, new, you name it. If you can't find it there, it's probably not around. And I found myself walking out without buying something, which is unfathomable to me, because the two or three albums I thought, oh, I should purchase this, I went, you know what, I could just stream it on Spotify.
Well, the problem is not the fact that there's Spotify and Netflix and all these other new services springing up. The problem is the royalty rate.
Yes.
People should be making more money off the plays. You got to withhold your music. It's like China. Don't show your movie in China until you can get a better cut. That's why Tom York and Radiohead and Black Keys and Amy Mann and AC/DC and Garth Brooks and Led Zeppelin, they're not on Spotify, because they're not getting a good royalty rate. And they say, I'm not going to give you my music so you can make a lot of money and I get nothing.
You know, I really liked the way Byrne, I mean, there's a lot of research that went into this piece. It's a very long piece. And he says that Spotify is the second largest source of digital music revenue for labels in Europe, according to the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, or IFPI. And I thought, he knows that? That's, I mean, it's not too hard to look up, but he knows that? And then he goes on to say, you know, I managed to check stuff out without using Spotify or Pandora, any of these services, I'll go directly to the artist's website or to Bandcamp or even Amazon. And I'm thinking, he knows about Bandcamp? But
of course he does. Every artist knows about Bandcamp. Yes, but the result is then the artist gets nothing.
Well, with Bandcamp,
they stream it for free on their own website, right?
Yes.
Right. So there you go. You go there, you listen to the music, and they get zero on each play. Rather than 0.01 penny, they get 0.0.
Yes. Well, but then they're in total control of it. And I think that's where we're headed. Right now, as you mentioned, Michael, sometimes you need a label to get off the ground. You just need one. And I think more and more what will wind up happening is artists will start releasing their own work via the internet. They won't need a label. The good stuff will rise to the top through, you know, viral activity. People will pass it along. Radio stations will find it and play it. And they will own the rights. So all that money that is going to labels now and then trickling down very slowly, if at all, to artists will go directly to the artist. It'll be a
what a lovely fantasy that is.
It'll be a complete nightmare to try and get that. Now, here's something that is worth mentioning. What Byrne points out is that, and I guess I'll read this directly. He writes, Spotify gave $500 million in advances to major labels in the U.S. for the right to license their catalogs. That was a quote-unquote advance against income. So theoretically, it's not the label's money to pocket. Another chunk of change is soon to follow.
There's lots of money out there.
Yes. And here's the key point. The labels also got equity. So they are now partners and shareholders in Spotify, which is valued at around $3 billion. That income from equity, when and if the service goes public, does not have to be shared with the artists. It seems obvious that some people are making a lot of money on this deal, while the artists have been left with meager scraps. What's interesting about that is, as equity shareholders, it is in their best interest for Spotify to pay as little as possible for its product.
Of course, right. And they'll profit without the artists getting money. So the problem is not that Spotify exists. The problem is that the artists aren't getting their fair share of the profits. Money is being made on Spotify and Netflix and all these other services, but it's not going to the artists who create the material. So, like when you make a movie or whatever, you make a movie or you write a book or whatever, you need to fight for a better royalty rate before you hand over your creative content. And of course, it's not so easy to do it on your own website. I know this artist, Jimmer Podrasky. He was with the Rave Ups, a big band in the early 80s, sort of Americana before Americana was cool. They were depressed before there even was no depression. But they were a small cult band. They appeared in the movies Pretty in Pink and on Beverly Hills 90210. They had a rock hit, I think, with Respectfully King of Rain and Positively Lost Me. And they were around for a while, and they've disappeared, but they've always been beloved. And now Jimmer Podrasky's gone out, and he's got a solo album. It's his first music in 23 years. He's got a website, Jimmer Music. JIMMERmusic.com. But guess what? His album's not available on iTunes. It's not available on Amazon. You got to go to his website to find it, because if you go to iTunes to buy it, they get 30% of the sale. So it's really hard to even make your music available for sale without giving up a huge chunk to some other company. So, you know, he has his own website. You can go there and stream the music. You can buy the album direct, but getting him to find your album on his own direct website rather than going to iTunes or Amazon, that's really, really hard.
What's his name?
Jimmer Podrasky of the Rave Ups.
Okay, so, and they used to be a big deal, but aren't so much anymore.
His first new music in 23 years is a big deal.
Okay, well then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is one that I probably could have, you know, chopped out of a previous episode of Showbiz Sandbox and just dumped right here. Why? Because it's about Stretch Armstrong and the movie that they're trying to make of this beloved toy, which they never seem to be able to make this movie. The folly of announcing release dates long before a movie has started production. Remember, that Stretch Armstrong movie, as I mentioned, we've talked about it a lot. It's the one based on that toy by Hasbro. Well, it was supposed to come out April 11th of next year, but never even started filming. Now the people behind it admit the project is, well, for lack of a better word, dead. At one point, it was going to star Taylor Lautner of Twilight, but he couldn't get a green light, and Stretch is going back on the shelf. I get it, because it's a toy. It's going back on the shelf.
Yeah, I get it.
It's not on the floor, you know, to be cleaned up, you know. In any case, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Taylor Lautner already dropped out of the project. It just goes to show how quickly your fame fades. Poor Taylor Lautner. He had sort of one big action film, you know, that flopped. The Twilight movies are over. God help him, you know. I hope he's looking at TV projects right now. But the problem with this whole project is that they're making a movie about Stretch Armstrong when they should be making a movie about Plastic Man, which is the comic book that Stretch Armstrong ripped off. Plastic Man is a brilliant comic book created by Jack Cole. It's weird, it's witty, it's funny, it's strange, it has a great sensibility, and there's actual storylines to make a movie. And that's the one thing Stretch Armstrong likes. It's just a toy. So, you know, they're starting from scratch there, and they're syndicating, they're franchising the wrong product. It should be the actual work of art, Plastic Man.
The major broadcasters are appealing their case against Barry Diller's Aereo antenna service. We've talked about it numerous times here on the show. They're appealing it all the way to the Supreme Court. Aereo is an end run around cable monopolies by providing free over-the-air broadcast channels to subscribers via personalized antennas. They don't pay the networks for the right to rebroadcast a signal because they say it's, you know, free and over-the-air as it is, free and over-the-air. Expect a hearing at the Supreme Court where judges ask what the difference is between Aereo and rabbit ears, while wondering exactly what a DVR might be.
I'm saying the Supreme Court people aren't exactly technologically savvy. Your 80-year-old grandmother isn't the best person to talk about technology.
True. But here is my big question, Michael. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal.
That's right.
And
it is.
It's kind of fascinating because some people are very unhappy that they're pushing this case and in the way they're pushing it. Because what matters is not just what case you take to the Supreme Court, but how you frame your arguments. And Cablevision, for one, says they're making a big mistake, the networks. They say the way they're challenging this tactic is so broad, legally speaking, that it would call into question the legality of everything from DVRs to cloud-based services to digital lockers. And so win or lose, they're going to be opening a can of worms that they're not going to be happy about down the road. So it's kind of fascinating.
I agree.
We'll see what happens.
I thought that Aereo or the networks trying to take on Aereo, the bad news for them is they're going for the nuclear option, because if the Supreme Court rules, hey, this is illegal, boom, it's illegal, and Aereo is dead in the water. Rather than taking them on city by city and forcing Aereo to spend all these marketing dollars to sustain itself, you know, this is a kind of winner-take-all fight at this point.
Yeah.
Speaking of winners, the great short story writer Alice Munro announced her 14th collection of tales back in 2012, and she said that it was going to be her last. That's what she said back in 2012. Just like Philip Roth, she was going to retire. But unlike Philip Roth, Munro went out with a flourish. The Canadian author, whose work has been unstintingly praised for decades, won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yay!
In typical Canadian fashion, she tried to stay out of the spotlight and named all the other Canadian authors she hoped this would bring attention to. But no such luck. It was the most praised choice of the Nobel Prize authorities, committees, in years. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. So often their choices seem politically motivated, or they're trying to make a statement, just like their Peace Prize. You know, they're trying to interfere with history or make some political commentary rather than just naming the best writer in the world whose career deserves, you know, recognition. This one, I don't think there's any question about it. She's a great short story writer, probably the best since Peter Taylor, the Southern writer, and one of the best worldwide in many a moon, a great author. Any book you grab from her is going to be good. You just can't go wrong. She's got about 14 collections, I think, and then, you know, greatest hits like Selected Stories or her new Selected Stories, which came out a few years ago. Anything you grab from her is going to be good.
Well, that brings us to from one end of the age spectrum all the way to the other, to 16-year-old pop star Lorde, who has the number one song for the second week in a row. Her tune Royals is a smash hit, while her album debuts at number three. I guess it was released last week. She's not the youngest artist to ever hit number one in the U.S. That's, of course, Michael Jackson, who hit number one at 11 years old with I Want You Back.
11. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. She's not even the youngest woman. That would be Little Peggy March, who had a big hit with I Will Follow Him back in 1963 at the age of 15. She missed it by that much.
I hope she was following her father because she's only 15. But anyway.
Yes. But if she's lucky... Well, if Lorde is lucky, she might have a number one album and song soon, and she's already the first New Zealander in history to top the U.S. charts. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's certainly a big deal for her. Whether it's the start of a big career, I'm not quite sure yet. The nice thing is it's about the music. It's not because she had some big YouTube smash hit, though, of course, that has, you know, followed the success of the song, but it seems to be about the music and about the quality of the songwriting and the melodies and the music, not some catchy, silly video or her tramping herself out like some other young female pop stars we can mention. So it's a nice change of pace.
Why don't you want to say Miley Cyrus's name? I don't get it.
She's going to be fine. She's at like number three with Wrecking Ball. So don't worry about her.
Well, you know, here's an interesting related story. 5 months ago, I wanted to get tickets to see this 16-year-old New Zealander who had this hit song, Royals. No album, just this
creepy,
one.
Creepy.
Just this one song. Well, hold on a second. She was playing at a venue, at a theater, and I thought, oh, I can just wait. You know, I'll just wait until tomorrow morning and purchase tickets then.
Why would you ever wait?
Because nobody knew who she was back then.
Says you.
Yeah, apparently all the teeny boppers did because they scooped up all those tickets and it was one of the hottest tickets in Los Angeles this year.
Big mistake.
5 months early. 5 months.
Always buy tickets the second they're ready. Never
wait. General admission. In any case.
All the more reason.
We're bouncing all over the age range here because now we're going to be talking about Meg Ryan, who's making a big move into TV and People Magazine is not happy about it at all. Wait, what? Why would People Magazine care? Well, they look a little silly because on October 2nd, they did a big cover story about how Meg Ryan doesn't care about Hollywood and is focusing on her 8-year-old daughter and her boyfriend, John Mellencamp. That's all she cares about.
She's dating John Mellencamp?
Where have you been?
I had no idea.
Apparently, you do not go to the supermarket at all.
I don't.
Hollywood is for people obsessed.
She's dating John Mellencamp.
Yes. And she doesn't care about Hollywood because it's for people obsessed with careers. Meg lives in New York City and loves her life out of the spotlight.
Doesn't John Mellencamp live in India? He lives in New York? Or are they just dating by jet?
Part-time he lives in New York, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, 9 days afterwards, after people had this article.
I'm done with Hollywood.
Meg Ryan announces she's signed on to a sitcom for NBC. The 51-year-old Ryan will play a New York City book editor who returns to the publishing world and finds herself working for a 30-year-old kid, kind of like our lives. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Woman gets job, as Karen would say if she was here on the air right now. But yeah, you know, she's 51, which means in Hollywood years, she's like 107 as far as they're concerned. So, you know, if she finds the right project and the right role, if this is a quality show, and I bet she has a deal that says it goes on Thursday night because God knows they need shows and she's a big name. And that's exactly what NBC needs. So, you know, if it's the right quality people in the right role, it could restart her, you know, career, which she says she's kept in the back burner. But it's always nice to have people calling in asking you to work in their movies, isn't it?
I guess it is. Yes. And well, that's a story about somebody getting a job. Let's talk about somebody who's not. I think somebody had second thoughts, don't you, Michael?
Perhaps.
Charlie Hunnam of TV's Sons of Anarchy has dropped out of the biggest role of his entire career and probably the biggest role he'll ever get.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay, at least for now. The bondage-obsessed billionaire in 50 Shades of Grey, that was the role. Hunnam's people announced rather unconvincingly that his heavy TV schedule was making it impossible for Hunnam to properly prepare for the role. Because everyone knows how much you need to practice spanking, I guess. Is this a big deal or a big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, because it's a big project. A lot of people paying attention to it. You know, the hoopla surrounding the casting of this film was huge. So to have him suddenly back out and go, wait, I don't think I want to do this. That's kind of crazy. I mean, that must have been a nightmare call for his agent to make. And I would point out he has two other films in pre-production. Is he dropping out of the cop drama 999, directed by John Hillcoat? Is he dropping out of Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak? I don't think so. So clearly he just said, I don't suddenly feel really good about this movie. I don't think it was the attention so much as he realized how a potentially nightmarish bad project this could be and didn't want to take the risk. Hey, it could turn out to be sexy and great, but it's a very difficult movie to make well since it's a crappy book, you know, poorly written junk, and it's sort of a pop cultural joke at this point. And so it's just a project you really got to have a lot of faith in the director and the material to feel comfortable spanking a woman and being bondagey and all that sort of silly stuff.
Right. And I think also, you know, there is a whole time crunch issue. They started shooting the first week of November is when they're scheduled to start shooting 50 Shades of Grey. He gets off of Sons of Anarchy October 21st. So there's like 2 weeks.
He knew that. Give me a break.
I know.
It's not about his TV schedule.
I don't know. But whoever set that scheduling up, not good scheduling.
Well, that's because they probably already have the release date picked out, isn't it?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, it's just stupid. But, you know, Charlie Hunnam, he was on the UK version of Queer as Folk. Terrific in that as a kid. He was great in Sons of Anarchy. He's been in some other shows. You know, he's a talented actor. So I don't think I think he's got a good career ahead of him. I mean, he's already made great stuff, and I think he could get a great plum role. I don't think this was necessarily it. So he's probably better off.
Well, we talked about somebody who's getting a job, somebody who is, I don't know,
turning
down a job. And let's talk about somebody who didn't even know their job was on the line. Because it's usually a good idea to start looking for a new job when your bosses have to release statements saying that they are not going to fire you. When you have to make that public, you know what? If your boss is making that public, I'll look for another job.
Let me say right now, Sperling, you are the host and producer of Showbiz Sandbox, and I have every confidence you will remain so for the foreseeable near future.
Hold on, I'm just making a note. Prepare resume. It's usually a good idea, as I mentioned, to start looking for that new job when that happens. But that's the situation for CNN host Piers Morgan right now, who has resolutely failed to fill the shoes of Larry King in the plum 9 p.m. slot on CNN, or as I like to call it on the West Coast, the 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. slot. When the network hired the affable Bill Weir of ABC's Nightline, they were forced to publicly insist that he wasn't there, wasn't hired, to replace Morgan. Weir is set for 11 p.m. or later slot, or as I like to call it in the West Coast, 8 a.m., 8 p.m. or 11 p.m. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal.
What?
It's not a big deal in this. It's a big deal because someone better be hired to replace Morgan. And guess what? We've got someone on the sidelines ready and waiting. That's Katie Couric. There's big talk now in syndication world that her show will not be renewed for 2014. People have to make that decision now. It's like within the next few weeks, she's going to find out whether her show is going to continue or not. They'd have to cut back the budget. They'd have to cut back this and that. People keep pressuring her to make dumb shows that they think housewives want to see. She says, no, I want to do serious, hard fare. You know, she'll do a show on like a abused wives, and she'll lead with the Harvard psychologist rather than an abused wife who can give a tearful story. They're like, please lead with the human beings and follow up with the experts. And she says, no, I want to do serious journalism. It's all a nightmare. The kid show may in fact come to a dead halt in the next few weeks, and I can't, you know, Jeff Zucker's at CNN.
That's
he needs
where,
somebody.
Yep.
She belongs at CNN. 9 p.m. slot where she gets to interview intelligent people and do the mix that you did on the Today Show. It's perfect for her. So
I agree.
For God's sakes, wake up.
Hold on, I'm making a call right now to Mr. Zucker. We've talked to him in the past.
I wish you
right?
would.
Yes. Well, we I know one thing is for sure. We recently teased the pop artist MIA about her legal spat with the NFL. Remember that? That was like a few episodes.
I do.
Well,
I'm making a symbol with my finger right now.
That's true. You're saluting her.
I think she's fine. She's cool.
Okay. Well, when she's doing something cool, I guess we should give her some credit. The Sri Lankan activist/musician/artist was contacted by the design house Versace and asked to come up with ideas for a clothing line. Rather cleverly, MIA became intrigued with the many knockoffs of Versace styles that proliferate around the world, especially the many styles that she found in her own wardrobe. I threw in that last part. Every time they release a new line, copycat black market people do riffs on the looks, and they get them out to the stores and the street stalls almost immediately. MIA became obsessed with all these refractions of Versace and decided to rip off the ripoffs. She designed a line that took its inspiration from the knockoff lines that took their inspiration from Versace. It was like a snake eating its own tail. The house loved the idea, by the way. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things, but it's a very clever idea. I think it's really cool. So that's a neat, nifty idea, and I can't wait to see how it turns out.
Can we talk? No? Okay.
Sure. I thought it was rhetorical. It usually is when Joan Rivers says it.
That's right. We're talking about Joan Rivers, who has settled a bitter dispute with the Writers Guild of America. She's the star and executive producer of Fashion Police, one of the reality shows that the WGA picketed because it was pushing for more recognition for its writers, who on that show are likely to be called producers, no doubt. Contractually, Rivers had to continue hosting the show, but the WGA insisted that doing so meant Rivers was also writing the dialogue she would deliver. Rivers agreed to stop writing this material for herself, which she felt was materially different from delivering scripts for the show. So she's saying, you say write, I say wrote. What's the difference?
But she agreed to stop.
Yes. She also agreed to push the E! Channel to meet and settle with the writers. The WGA in turn dropped all charges against Rivers, which might have led to sanctions and possible expulsion from the guild. Does this microphone make my voice sound fat, Michael? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
That's pretty good. It's a big deal because they pressured a big star to take action. She caved, or she finally agreed to do what they said that she should do, and she's going to use her ability and power to push the network into making a deal with the Writers Guild. I think we all know that writers are woefully underpaid and undercredited on all these reality shows, which are going to be with us forever. So it needs to happen, needs to be done. They need to hold, they need to stand firm and get stuff changed, and this is an important step towards it. If a big member like this, like Joan Rivers, can defy them and just continue writing, that makes it very hard for them to find pressure with the networks.
Not since the Beatles has... I can't start off a story that way. That's going a little overboard. Because not since the disintegration of, say, the Backstreet Boys or NSYNC has the pop world been roiled by such heartache. Yes, the Jonas Brothers have canceled their upcoming 19-city tour. The series of dates were pretty modest to begin with, and it doesn't seem they were, setting any ticket sales on fire to between you and me and, say, the rest of the world. Nonetheless, the three brothers have sold 20 million albums in the past 6 years and have released some songs from their upcoming album, but CNN reports, and lots of people were reporting, I guess, thanks to Twitter, that the trio is fighting over the musical direction of the group, and somehow this means the tour is off. Off, I tell you. The album, they insist, will continue to be worked on. Nick and Joe have released solo albums, and Kevin stars in a reality series with his wife called Married to Jonas, speaking of reality television. And, I guess maybe that show will be retitled Married to... Who is that again? Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's weird. You're having fights over musical direction. What's that got to do with the tour? They're doing their greatest hits and a few new songs. So I'm not quite sure what's going on here. I imagine ticket sales didn't help. Their first show was in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, not exactly Madison Square Garden. So maybe that just made them all feel like this is not worth it. I don't know what's going on, but it's supposed to conclude in Seattle on November 6th. That's obviously a big city. Fans get refunds. But, this was a talented group, and I don't understand why there's a rift, because everyone knows Nick is in charge. He tells you what to do. He's the president. But apparently they lost that thread, and now they're falling apart. I don't think we'll see them again.
Well, since we've spent a lot of time talking about reality TV, maybe we should move on to, reality TV. Because if you think they've run out of ideas for reality shows and talent contests, think again. The Sci-Fi Channel is launching a puppet-building contest. This is a great idea. Contestants vie for a job at Jim Henson's Creature Shop.
I love puppetry, so leave it alone.
This is a great idea. I think this is a fantastic idea. And
I don't think it's going to be a big hit show.
Well, though
I don't think it's a breakout reality show, no.
Well, even though the diving show competition, Splash on ABC, did a big belly flop, another one is in the works that will involve even more challenging, they're going to try and take celebrities and turn them into gymnasts.
That's insane.
Bad idea. Celebs will train hard to compete in gymnastics events like rings, floor, and uneven bars. Famed gymnasts like Shannon Miller and Paul Hamm are linked to the project as well, as is, I believe, Mary Lou Retton. Are these shows a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I don't think puppet building is going to set the world on fire, but the gymnastics show is a horrific idea. And Paul Hamm, gold medal winner. I love him. I like his brother, but he has a squeaky voice. He makes me sound, like Orson Welles. He has a very high pitched voice. I don't see him coming across well on TV. He does very poorly in interviews. So the idea he's going to be a celebrity judge, it's just horrific. Gymnastics is really, really hard. You can't have people doing stuff so hard that they can only do it sloppily and poorly at best. Jumping into water is easy compared to doing the rings. It's not easy. It's scary, but it's still, anybody can jump. But anyway, don't get upset because reality shows and talent contests have been with us forever. So don't think that this is some big trend and thing that's going to fade away and they'll finally get over, because it's been with us for 100 years now, since the early days of radio. So just get used to it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last bit. I'm writing. I'm just trying to finish up my pitch for a reality show about celebrities in a hospital after being injured on another reality show.
And with celebrity doctors, yes. Celebrities who've played doctors on TV, serving as their actual doctor in the emergency room. Stat! That's all I know what to say.
Epi. Give me another ounce of Epi. What is Epi? Somebody define Epi for me.
Yes, so we'll be one of the four people watching the Sci-Fi Channel puppet show.
I think that's a great idea. I do.
Oh, by the way, we finally got the numbers in. I knew it would happen while we were recording. The Walking Dead's new season premiere hit 16 million people for its first view. That does not include the DVR numbers for the rebroadcast later in the evening, but 16 million people for that first broadcast, which is a record, of course. It's the, you know, it's still growing four seasons in.
Wow.
So 16 million people, that was up more than 5 million from last October's opener, which was 10.9 million people. So that is just amazing. Among adults 18 to 49, they had 10 million viewers. That's even bigger than Sunday Night Football, which even beat the baseball postseason. That's how big football is. So The Walking Dead, wow. That's a lot of viewers.
Well, I would say, Michael, those numbers from Walking Dead over on AMC are a big deal, wouldn't you? I mean, that's...
Absolutely.
Well, that must mean it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week's topic is really all about you, because it's all about social media, because I'm sure if you were watching The Walking Dead on cable, on AMC, you were probably also, of course, you know, typing on your laptop, and you had your iPhone out and one of your Android phones and your tablet. And I know that's what Karen Woodward does when she watches television, because she is the social media queen of Hollywood. Of course, she used to be the co-host here on Showbiz Sandbox, but she just got too big for us. And then she left to actually run most of the social media campaigns in Hollywood. Karen, thank you for joining us.
I don't know if I would go that far, but I do like that introduction.
Well, now you're kind of well-versed in social media, and there's been all of these stories about this little service on the internet called the Facebook, and then there's one that a lot of people like called the Twitter, and yeah. And all these companies, of course, I'm joking, everybody knows Facebook and Twitter, but they are trying to become world dominant in television, of all things. How in the world do you go from social media to television?
Pretty easily, actually, because on Twitter, there are the two top categories that people tweet about are sports, which is absolutely the number one, and then a little bit further down is TV.
But if you're watching sports
and
on TV...
So they watch The Walking Dead, and they say, oh my God, I can't believe the finale, and they send it to all their friends.
Well, but it's more than just that. I mean, they're on Twitter, and now they're on Facebook, and they're talking about what they're seeing as they're watching it.
Okay, so it's a constant streaming commentary on the show.
It is, and if you'll notice that a lot of the shows, especially the reality shows, like the competition shows like American Idol and The Voice, now actually include hashtags on the broadcast as you're watching them. And American
constantly,
Idol
constantly, stay or go. Those hashtag stay or go. Hashtag, you know, best song. Hashtag, you know,
yeah,
Ryan Seacrest.
Exactly. And with the dancing shows now, they will say something like, it's like hashtag DWTS and then like, you know, rumba or whatever it is that they're doing, so that people know exactly which hashtag to use to talk about what is currently going on. So they're segmenting it from just Dancing with the Stars, hashtag DWTS, to, you know, that particular moment within that show.
So Twitter is capitalizing on that relationship with TV shows. People use Twitter to talk to other people about the show minute by minute. How are they building on that to extend their business?
Oh, they just announced a deal with Comcast last week for a product called See It. And what it is that if a...
But this is not the letter C. It's like C, like with your eyes.
C, like S-E-E. Yeah, See It. So... what it will do is if you tweet about something and you link to, you know, a website that has a bit of code in it, you can actually tune in and watch the show or schedule it on your DVR or you know, watch it on demand, like as you're tweeting about it.
So is this something that I have to do as an end user that is posting to Twitter, that I have to make sure that the See It code is there?
It actually comes from the other way. So people who are like from NBC or who are tweeting from Comcast Xfinity, we are the ones who will be using that. We are the ones who have to make sure that we link to the proper page. So it's really, it's the end user then who benefits from it.
So when I tweet and say, last night's episode of The Blacklist was the best yet. That's the James Spader show on NBC. And I send it. Does that mean you automatically include this link to see it where people can go look at the latest episode, or is that something that I press a button and make happen?
Well, that it works like a Twitter card. Are you guys familiar with Twitter cards at all?
Nope.
Yes,
nope.
That's when you meet somebody from Twitter who works there. They give you a business card.
I don't even know if they have business cards, to be honest. A Twitter card is a piece of meta tag, which might be too meta for people, but it's a piece of code that is in a website. So, for example, like NBC Universal, if they wanted to talk about like the Michael J. Fox show, they could tweet something and then they could link to the Michael J. Fox show page. And on that page is a little bit of code so that when the link goes out within that tweet, it automatically renders a card called a Twitter card that will tell you a little bit about the show. So now what's happening is that they're taking it one step further. So not only will you see information about the show, but you will be able to click on something which will take you to where you can watch it right now, if it's on right now, or to schedule your DVR, or to find out if it's available on demand.
How is it going to schedule my DVR?
Because
I'm a Comcast customer.
You go through a normal process like you would for like Hulu. And it says, who is your provider? And so you have to walk through an initial setup process. But after that, it should know you.
Okay, and so again, if I tweet about Blacklist, how does this all get started?
It's not going to come up unless you happen to link to a page that has that.
Okay.
But by the way, it's not meaningful necessarily for you to do it. This is really more meaningful for content owners people to watch the show.
So
as opposed to just talking about it, you know, people will now hopefully be following these handles and will not only be getting information about the show, but also know exactly when they can watch it. And maybe that's right this second.
So Twitter cards are basically a way because Twitter is 140 characters or less. That's what the posts are. And so it's a way to provide more information to a Twitter post than the 140 characters.
Right.
And this is done through, you know, automatically through certain code, website code or markup language that is placed on a website. So if Michael were to say, hey, last night's Blacklist was great and linked to nothing, then
nothing's going to happen.
Whereas if he says, oh, it was great, here's a link to the Blacklist website,
right,
then the Twitter card will be there, not because he knew it was going to be there, but because that code happens to be on that link.
Happens to be there. But, you know, that's only one way that Twitter is getting involved in the space. They've partnered with Nielsen, and Nielsen's going to start measuring that. And they have acquired Bluefin Labs, which is well known for analyzing tweets and, you know, to see what people are talking about. And they want to see if there's a correlation between the number of tweets and a show's ratings, which there's not, but it's not to say that someday there won't be. Maybe there'll be two different rating systems.
Even if people are just tweeting and talking about it, they don't have to do anything more than let people use their space like Facebook and Twitter to make money on it, because they can data mine all that information and sell that to the broadcaster. And that's what Facebook is doing. They're saying, hey, we got 800 million people. They're talking about TV a lot. We're going to data mine all that and send reports to networks and give them data about what shows are being talked about, the age and names, you know, the ages and genres and demographics of the people who are doing it, how often they talk about it, how involved they are. Are they including links to the show? And they're going to use that info and sell it to the networks and make money off it that way.
And they're also going to convince networks to buy ads based off of all of that.
So that's really what they're doing. They're saying, look, we'll give you this data, okay? We're not giving it to everybody. We're going to give this to you, okay? You don't have to buy this data. But because it's so rich, it's so valuable, you're going to learn so much from it. When you want to reach specific target audiences, you know you can come to us because you know we know where all the people are.
That's
and they're going to give really targeted ad buys, like, you know, women between 20 and 35 for the new season of Dancing with the Stars, something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. No, Twitter's ad buy back end. I'll say that three times fast.
Ad buy back end. Oh, my God, there's Michael Keaton.
Twitter's back end for ad buying has become about as sophisticated as Facebook's.
And you use Facebook, and so you're getting all this data for the campaigns you're running on Facebook, whether it be an ad campaign or a social media campaign where you're trying to push something. And it's quite valuable to you. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's invaluable. It's so valuable. But Twitter does the same thing. I just think a lot of people don't advertise on Twitter because you only get these these interesting stats if you're paying $30,000 or more. Whereas on Facebook, anybody can do it.
Right. And so what are some of the things you learn on Facebook? Like what can you learn? I don't know, like whether I like ice cream.
Yeah, you can. Well, you can find out on both of them. You do find out other pages that these people like or other handles that people are following. So, for example, I had a client that was more of down market, and I saw that a lot of the people who were following that handle, my client's handle, were also following handles from like laundry detergent and, you know, supermarkets. And so you kind of learn who these people are. And yeah, you can learn the same thing on Facebook. It's not quite as easy to get. You might actually have to have a Facebook rep who gives it to you, but they've changed it a lot, so I could be wrong. But no, you can find out all the different pages that these people are following. I mean, you can, privacy is out the window.
Yeah. So what does this mean for listeners? Does it just mean I'm going to get ads that are more targeted to me and I'll mm-hmm. perhaps be more pleased by the ads, or how will I benefit? Or do I just feel like I'm a guinea pig that they're taking all my personal passions and turning it into money?
It depends on how you look at it. I mean, there are definitely people who believe that you are the guinea pig and they're making money off of your personal passions. But at the same time, you will see that ads are more targeted to you. Whether people are clicking through on them is a completely different story. But, you know, there's probably a reason why Facebook has adjusted a lot of their ads. They're not all just, you know, on the right rail of the Facebook page anymore. You're probably seeing a hell of a lot more of them now in your mobile stream.
I'm seeing a lot of sponsored ads on my page, and I like delete them and say I don't want them, and I identify them as spam because it really annoys me.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, because for Twitter, at least, those Twitter cards are great if you're on the website and you're looking at Twitter on the website. What happens when you're looking at it through the Twitter app, or you're looking at it through TweetDeck or Hootsuite or one of those platforms?
It's different, and it depends on which platform you're actually viewing it on. Twitter, I think, is still trying to figure out how that's going to look.
I noticed that they keep locking things down there. You know, thank you very much for all your support over the years, and good luck. We're no longer allowing you to do what you used to be able to do.
You meaning the advertisers?
Meaning the developers who built TweetDeck, which is...
Yeah, no, they keep shutting them out. It's interesting. I don't know what their plan is for mobile. You would think they would have a really good one, right? Considering they started off on mobile. But I don't see any ads on Twitter on my mobile device.
Well, what do you think all this means for television? Do you think it's going to affect television? I mean, I still remember... Michael, we were in Cannes, and there was a cinematographer for a film that was there that went on to be, I believe, nominated for an Academy Award. And she said it was 2008. She said, "What's a Twitter?" At the time, she had no idea what Twitter was. Now you have Nielsen saying, "Well, we're going to use some of these statistics to help rate television shows." What does it all mean?
Well, it's going to be Twitter's future, I think. I think it's the only way that Twitter is going to be able to monetize itself is by linking themselves to TV.
To TV or to anything that needs some kind of analytic metrics on what people are thinking?
Well, I think it's both, but I think that they have discovered that it's TV and especially people watching sports or dramas on TV that is their future.
Well, in their IPO statement, they mentioned the word television 42 times.
Mm-hmm. I read that article too.
And so, yeah, I mean, and there seems to be a bit of a battle between Facebook and Twitter as to who is more important to TV, whether it's Facebook or Twitter. Certainly, it seems to me that Twitter has the huge head start here.
Well, not only do they have the huge head start, but Twitter is more forgiving of people tweeting on a constant basis. So you could sit there and you could live tweet a show that you were watching. Facebook's not as forgiving of somebody doing that because it's simply not the way Facebook works. You know, Facebook, if you live tweeted something on Facebook, people are going to unfollow you.
So what if you live tweet something on Twitter, but then all of your posts go to Facebook?
Well, all of your posts should never be going directly to Facebook. If your Twitter should never, ever go to Facebook. Facebook can go to Twitter as long as it's short, but Twitter should never go to Facebook. Not if you're a constant Twitter.
I have to go.
But so no, that's the future of Twitter. There's no doubt about it. But that's why Facebook introduced hashtags, because they want to get in on that too. But I think it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, Facebook, and Zuckerberg has been faulted for this in the past, he's a great copier.
He he is. And but, you know, they've also done a lot of things that have crashed and burned. So
now, Mike, here's my question, because I restarted my Tumblr account recently. Sperling Speaks, by the way, sperlingspeaks.com. And so when is Tumblr going to get into the mix here? Because I'm still trying to figure out what the heck is Tumblr for.
And Vine and all the others.
Love Tumblr.
You, but what do you love it for? I'm still trying to figure out, okay, what do I post here? What am I supposed to like? Where do I go to look at this stuff? And who?
It's hard to navigate. It's definitely hard to navigate.
Nobody follows me. Nobody likes any of the stuff I post. And I post good stuff.
You know, the thing about Tumblr, the way to go about Tumblr is to go about it kind of the opposite way. So you come in as a lurker, and then you start reposting, and then you start doing your own stuff. That's how I became much more involved in Tumblr, because I've got two Tumblrs. I've got Tumblr is me, which I've got like no followers and I'm totally boring and I'm hardly ever there. And then I've got my fangirl Tumblr, where it's just like all the TV shows that I watch. And you start finding people who are fangirls or boys at the same shows that you are. And they create, you know, they create GIFs and they create collages, and it's like they do this crazy stuff. And I just follow them and reblog. And at some point I will, you know, I'll get to the point where I know how to do that too. And I'll be much more a part of their community that way. So I would think that the best way to enter Tumblr is by listening. I'm not sure there's any other way.
Well, I've learned a lot in the last 2.5 minutes. I had no idea.
Unless, of course, you are a TV show, because, for example, NCIS and NCIS LA and Pretty Little Liars, and they actually put out some really fun content. And people who are fans of those shows will follow them. So they automatically become part of the community because they're putting out really good content, which is, you know, a rule of any social media
battle,
network
yeah.
that you're on.
So I just want to make sure I understand this. Produce a $3 million per episode television show so that you do really well on a social network like Tumblr.
Right. But you can also repurpose anything that you put on Facebook on Tumblr, because they're not always the same audience. Those people on Tumblr, I mean, they are fanboys and girls, I would say, between the ages of about 15 and 25.
I was going to say they are really boys and girls, because I've noticed that like
they're
16 years. Yeah, they are young.
So what I want to know, Karen, is you're talking about people looking at Twitter and saying, let's get a new measurement rating system that talks about how many shows are being tweeted about. Like we had that shark movie on Sci-Fi Channel that got crazy tweets. What was that called?
Sharknado.
Sharknado, yes. And they said, oh, look at that. But the ratings weren't big. But then they re-aired it and re-aired it and re-aired
and
it.
And
every time it got bigger ratings. Yeah. What I want to know is, you deal with Universal. They've got these cable boxes in people's homes. Why don't they just say, we can measure households tomorrow about everybody watching every show? They could have the best Nielsen rating ever.
Well, I can answer that question.
It ain't privacy, because they don't give a darn about our privacy.
Well, but they do care if...
They don't care.
Wait. They care if they look as if they're not caring. In other words...
They could do it without not caring. They say, we don't have your name. We don't have whatever. We're just anonymizing it.
And TiVo does that, and all the DVR information does that.
But right.
Quite honestly, all of the networks like the fact that there's a gray area. Because there's an old saying that 50% of my advertising budget is misspent. I just don't know which 50%. Well, what the networks don't want is for these advertisers to figure out that the 50% that is being misspent with them. So this little gray area, they kind of like...
Well, there's millions of studios who have shows and advertisers, all big players who would benefit from more accurate information. Saying your business is better because you have inaccurate information is pretty dumb.
Well, that's why Google is, you know, on top right now. And if you read, I think it's called In the Plex, or I can't remember the name of the book, but there's a whole chapter on this very subject.
So, Karen, what social media sites, what do we follow you on? If we want to follow you, and you're on everywhere, apparently, even on Vimeo, where do we go? How do we follow you?
I'm on Twitter at Karen_Woodward. Not particularly interesting.
Okay.
I'll be the first to admit. During the day, I talk about social media, and then at night, you'll know exactly what I'm watching and what I think. Sometimes I'm not very nice.
Well, Karen, thank you very much for... I don't know if you felt like you helped us unravel this spaghetti knot.
I'm completely obsessed with this whole area of social media and TV.
We had no idea.
Yeah, you should invite me back when I have more time. I'm happy to talk more about it.
What are you watching? What's your big show right now? Is it Blacklist? What is it?
I like Blacklist. I like Blacklist a lot. I have become completely obsessed with Betrayal for some unknown reason.
Oh, God help you. You better like it while it's still there, because it ain't going to last.
It's going to be canceled any second.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of it for the new shows.
You watch Scandal, obviously.
I watch Scandal. I think it's kind of silly, but I watch it anyway. You know, and I watch the old standbys like Grey's. I have this really weird new obsession for NCIS LA. I can't explain it.
You can't.
I can't explain it. I had it on in the background. I was like marathoning it all summer. And all of a sudden, I was like, it wasn't background TV anymore. It was like appointment television. I was totally obsessed.
So what about Netflix and House of Cards? I mean,
watched House of Cards. I was one of those people who was not particularly impressed with it.
Okay. So do you see those types of shows challenging linear television?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Of course.
Okay. Well, hey, you know what? I thought I'd ask somebody.
That's again the future. The future of TV is on demand. But I don't think linear television is going to go away anytime soon, because what's great about linear is that it's a schedule, and people kind of like to have a schedule.
Yes. Well, we're kind of on a schedule. We say that our show is only 60 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am on a schedule, and I'm 6 minutes late for my next meeting.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Okay. Well, Karen Woodward, Karen_Woodward on Twitter. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Invite me again.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Poor Karen watching Betrayal on ABC. There must be a word or a phrase for falling in love with a TV show you know is going to be canceled.
Kind of like Copper?
Yeah, you're gone. Yeah. It's kind of like working at a hospice.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I feel bad because I did tell her that we would be done before her meeting. And of course, we ran 6 minutes over, kind of like our show always does. It always runs over.
We don't run over because we don't have a set end time.
That's true.
Wait till we get on national syndicated radio. Then we'll have a set end time.
Yes. I believe they're going to say, well, why don't you just stay here? And we're going to be saying things like, wait, it's really dark in here. And what are all these brooms doing in here? See, it's a broom closet joke.
I got it.
Okay. Well, we do appreciate you spending all of this time with us each week. And again, if you would be so kind as to go to podcastawards.com and vote for Showbiz Sandbox, it would be greatly appreciated. Of course, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher or any place where they give away podcasts for free, anywhere they aggregate podcasts like the Microsoft Marketplace, for instance. You can rate and review the shows in those aggregators as well. We really do appreciate it. It does help us out. You can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @ShowbizSandbox. Couldn't be any easier. We're also on Facebook, where you can like our page. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and we should pop up. What else should we say? You can email us. You can email us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or even call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, all of that information, all those ways to contact us, subscribe to us, donate to us, or follow us.
Donate?
Yeah, you could donate through PayPal. That said, it's all on our website, showbizsandbox.com, which is also where you will find links to all the stories we discussed on today's show and links to some of Karen's work. Again, that website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have a new album out, but they can be found on MySpace or on their website, Who Is MGMT. Tonight, they're playing in Manchester, England at the O2 Apollo. Hey, don't go any further, otherwise we're going to have a copyright violation. Now, Michael, you have a website as well.
Yes, I do. It's rememberstalingrad.com.
Okay, I'm going to actually look up Stalingrad and figure out what that means. But just in case, try michaelgiltz.com to read some of Michael's work from the Huffington Post and elsewhere. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.